And now, your speaker, Jim McGill.
To turn in your New Testament to the 22nd chapter of Matthew, and we'll be starting our reading at verse 15. I think that the theme, I believe in Jesus, is so very, very appropriate. The song leader sang the song, "We saw thee not when thou didst come, but we believe." And as you remember the song, the lines, one line after another, mentions the things that we were not firsthand witnesses of, and yet at the same time, because of the inspired testimony of those who were there, we believe. And that's the reason why this theme, I believe in Jesus, is so important. Because as Jesus said when he was talking to Thomas, who had doubted, and finally said, "My Lord and my God," you remember Jesus said, "Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed." And when we read that verse of the words of Jesus, it comes right down to us that he is looking to us, people who didn't see, but still, based on the testimony, have believed. And when we think about the theme, I believe in Jesus, we realize how much more important it is that young people at a young age have the faith instilled, the positive things, the simple faith in Jesus, and not the negatives. My daddy obeyed the gospel when he was 88 years of age, and he had overcome all of his doubts. And I remember when he made the confession of faith, how firm it was, and what an emotional experience it was. And I had the opportunity to baptize him for the remission of sins, and it was a wonderful occasion, but not nearly so wonderful as it would have been if he had obeyed the gospel 70 or 75 years earlier, and have had all those years when he could have been leading other people to Christ. And so, with the young people studying the theme, I believe in Jesus, it is of such value. And this occasion, this evening, as we read the 22nd chapter of Matthew, starting at verse 15, is very faith-building too. Jesus had entered Jerusalem for the last time. The events leading up to the crucifixion were near at hand, and they were out to kill Jesus and just waiting for an opportunity because so many people believed in him and they were not ready to make their move as yet. But this was the occasion on which all three of the sects of the Jews, one by one, made their strongest argument and were unsuccessful. And at the end of this passage, the record says, "And after this, dared no man ask him any more questions. He had completely answered them all." And this first one deals with paying taxes to Caesar, starting with Matthew 22 and verse 15. "Then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent out unto him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Master, we know that thou art true, and teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of man." Here we see the Pharisees working with the Herodians, and it's the only time on this occasion as recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that the Herodians are mentioned anywhere. And we're told that this was a political force that started back when Herod the Great, so-called, the one who was Herod at the time Jesus was born, that they showed their support to Rome by supporting Rome's appointed king, King Herod. And that was their political angle. And so the question that they're going to ask is going to be one of their favorite questions. But we notice how they set him up with, or attempted to, with flattery. And we know they were not sincere because Jesus perceived their wickedness, as we'll read in a moment. But they said some good things about him. And this one where they said that he regardeth not the person of men was a high compliment. And it was true. And if they had meant it, it would have been genuine, because Jesus never had respect of persons. But notice their question. "Tell us, therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not?" Well, at this time, Judea and Galilee and Samaria and Perea had all been under Roman control, as most of the rest of the world was, and it had gone on decade after decade. And now at this point, Tiberius, the son of Augustus, is the Caesar in Rome, and the question is it lawful to pay taxes? And we, of course, know how distasteful this must have been, because you know, it's bad enough to pay sales taxes and real estate taxes and income taxes and all of that to our own government, but to think of having to pay taxes to support a foreign government, we realize, we can appreciate how unpopular that would be. And so if Jesus had answered, yes, it is lawful, it would have gone against his popularity rating quite a bit. But on the other hand, if he had said, no, it is not, then we can see he would have been in trouble with the government, and these Herodians would have come right back to the Roman authorities and have said, Jesus taught that it's not lawful to pay taxes to Caesar. Caesar, of course, the name adopted by a family name of Julius Caesar, and this was his grandson, Tiberius, who also called himself Tiberius Caesar. But Jesus, verse 18, perceived their wickedness and said, why tempt ye me, ye hypocrites? We know that definition. Hypocrite is a person who's acting a part, pretending to be something he isn't. And Jesus just said, show me the tribute money. We're told that when the Israelites were paying the temple tax and anything that had to do with the faith, they used the Jewish coinage, but in paying the taxes, they were supposed to use the Roman coins. And so they brought unto him a penny, and that's the translation of the word denarius. And of course, we know money values are very different from time to time, but we can put ourselves in picture here, and even if I have to think for a while to know whose picture is on a nickel and then whose picture is on a dime and whose is on a quarter, I always remember that Abraham Lincoln's image is stamped on the penny, and so they didn't have any trouble answering this either, because when Jesus said, whose is this image and superscription, they say unto him, Caesar's. Then saith he unto them, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's, that are God's. When they showed him the coin, and it was the penny, and he asked whose was the image, the stamped on it, the likeness of, it was the likeness of Tiberius, and Tiberius's name was on there too. One of the things that was very interesting in a commentary that Brother Burton Kaufman wrote on the book of Matthew at this passage, and this was the first of a long series of books of commentaries that Brother Kaufman wrote. One of the things that's interesting is that, to me, that Brother Kaufman was about 60 years old when he started this project. And he went to the publisher, the Firm Foundation at that time, and as he was bringing the manuscripts for one volume after another, he said to Brother Lemons, he said, I just pray that the Lord will let me live to finish this commentary on the New Testament. And so years passed, and Brother Burton Kaufman brought in the commentary, the manuscript, the typescript to be set in type for the book of Revelation. And they talked for a while in Brother Lemon's office, and when Brother Kaufman was about to leave, Brother Lemon said, now, Brother Kaufman, you be careful out there. And Brother Kaufman said, what do you mean? I'm always careful. Brother Lemon said, well, if you remember a few years ago, you told me, I just hope the Lord will let me live until I finish this commentary on the New Testament. And he said, there it is. This is the book of Revelation. That's the end. You're on your own now. So Brother Kaufman came back immediately. He said, oh, years ago, I changed that. I prayed the Lord let me live to finish the commentary on the whole Bible. And so he has now, has done that. Of course, Brother Kaufman had the advantage that his mother and daddy both lived to be past 100. And so he had that longevity in his favor. But he preached for the Manhattan congregation on East 80th Street in New York City for a number of years. And one of the things he mentioned was going by a coin museum in New York City. And one of the things he was most interested in was seeing an actual coin from that, like the one that they showed Jesus. And it did, as he said, have the image of Tiberius Caesar, and that you could make out the letters Tiberius Caesar. And so it makes it certainly brings it closer to home to think about some of those coins still being preserved. But this principle that Jesus stated, he didn't say yes or no, But he said, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. It makes us realize that the New Testament teaches us that we have a loyalty to our government, but a higher loyalty to God. And you remember how that was expressed by the apostles in the early church in Jerusalem in the book of Acts, when the authorities admonished them not to preach any more in the name of Jesus. And they said, we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. We must obey God rather than men. And that was what they did, in spite of the law. When the law told them to do something that they could not do as Christians, they had to obey God rather than men. But in all periods of history, there have been times when there have been those kinds of conflicts. You think back to the time when the children of Israel were in Egypt before they went across the Red Sea to freedom and eventually to the promised land. When they were slaves in the land of Egypt, dwelling in the land of Goshen, that section of Egypt, and the Pharaoh issued an order to try to stop their multiplying by ordering, as you recall, that all the male babies among the Israelites were to be put to death at birth. And this was, of course, something that would have been not just, would have been murder and premeditated murder, but it would be murdering their own babies. And they just circumvented the law every way and did not follow it. They, when the midwives were called in to explain, and they explained that the babies were born before they got there. And you remember it was during this period that Moses was put in this little ark and was found by Pharaoh's daughter. But this was clearly a case where they, even though they didn't express it in the same words that the apostles did, that they must obey God rather than men. They had a loyalty obligation to the government to obey Pharaoh, but they had a higher obligation to God. Much later on in history, when the children of Israel, the Jews, were in captivity in Babylon, and there were three Jews that were given Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and you think of their situation as being far away from home in the capital city of a foreign land. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, in his arrogance, had a statue built, an image that was to signify worship to him. And on the very dedication day of the image, he had decreed that when the sound of the different instruments of music was heard, that everyone around the image was to bow before it in submission to the image, in submission to Nebuchadnezzar that it represented. And you think about these three Jews far away from home, how easy it would have been for them to say, well, we'll just pretend to do that. We won't mean it. We'll just have our fingers crossed and we'll go through the motions of bowing down. And it would have been easy for them to rationalize that way without the influence of home and a foreign land. But they absolutely refused. And it was very conspicuous that they didn't obey the command. But Nebuchadnezzar gave them another opportunity. For whatever reason they had disobeyed the first time, he'd give them another chance. And you may recall their answer. They said, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee that we will not worship thy gods, nor serve the golden image which thou hast set up. God did deliver them, but it was only after they had put God first above everything else, even their own lives. It wasn't many years later that we remember that Daniel got into a situation somewhat similar, and it was deliberately planned to entrap him. The Persians had taken over world power by this time, the Medo-Persian Empire, and the king had this rule that we remember the law of the Medes and Persians, that if he put his stamp into this wax and sealed whatever the decree was, that even he couldn't change his mind and he couldn't withdraw it, which was kind of a dumb thing to do. Brother John L. Rainey, who was a teacher that I had many years ago, said he would never have an automobile, even as a gift, if it was a new Cadillac, if it did not have a reverse gear on it, because sometimes you need to back up. But the Persian king had locked himself into this, that he himself couldn't change the rule. And what the enemies of Daniel did, you may recall, in order to entrap Daniel, they got the king to agree that nobody should pray to any god or man for a period of 30 days. And the king thought it was just to flatter and honor him. But they knew that Daniel wouldn't change his plan or practice. And it was his custom to pray regularly 3 times every day. He would go to the window facing his home country and Jerusalem and pray at morning, noon, and evening. And he did that just as soon as the law was enacted. He didn't change his practice at all. And, of course, this was reported, and Daniel was called to give an account. God delivered him. Now, you know, when you think about what you would have done or what I would have done, I might have said, and it would have been kind of a cop-out type of compromise, I might have said, well, I'll go ahead and pray 3 times a day just like I always have, but I just won't go to the window. I'll pray where I won't be seen. But Daniel didn't even make that kind of concession or compromise. He put God before the rule of the government. But coming to just one more example, and there could be many in the Scriptures perhaps, but you remember when the wise men from the east came into Jerusalem and they were inquiring about where the king of the Jews would be born. And the scribes, who knew very well about the prophecy in Micah, just immediately told them it would be in Bethlehem. And Herod was aware of this, and he told these men, "When you find out where he is, come and tell me that I may go and worship him also." But Herod was just insanely jealous, we know, because he didn't want any competition as king of the Jews. And he didn't bother to be aware that Jesus' kingdom was not of this world. And so he planned to find Jesus and kill him. And the wise men didn't know anything but that they would have gone right back to Herod and would have told him just as Herod told them to. But on the way back, the message from the Lord came to them to go back another way. And so they heeded the higher law and the higher rule. When we come down to our time, we realize that there have been situations in American history and the world today in which sometimes these things would be hard. Not right now, as far as we're concerned. We could be faithful Christians and good citizens at the same time. And that certainly doesn't mean that in order to be a good citizen, we have to approve of everything the Supreme Court rules or everything that the government does. We think about the fact that Paul wrote his words about being subject to the powers that be when Nero was the emperor of Rome. And Jesus talked about this when Tiberius was the emperor. And paying taxes doesn't mean that we're guilty of what the government does that's wrong. But there would be some times when it would be hard to make adjustments. I want to mention just one, and that was back during the war between the states when just about 7 months after Tennessee seceded from the Union and the Confederate flag went up over the state capitol and the United States flag came down, just 7 months later, the United States Army came into Nashville and Nashville surrendered without firing a shot, just as an open city, and the United States flag went back up and the Confederate flag came down. And we can think about how many adjustments you'd have to make back and forth. One of the things that's interesting is that when the Confederate flag came down in February of 1862, people were looking at the Capitol and thought the United States flag would go back up immediately, but it didn't, because there was thought to be, according to General Grant had been told, that the person who had the original Old Glory lived in Nashville, William Driver. He had been a sea captain in New England, had a wife and 2 small children, and he had made several voyages, and one of the ones, the one of which he was most proud, was the time when he went by an island where the people who had mutinied on the British ship, the Bounty, had vacated the island, and they had gone to Tahiti. And the Queen of Tahiti came out to William Driver and asked him for a favor. She said, these people have Christian values and their lifestyle is such that it's so different from ours that it hurts them to see the way we live. And so she said, for their sake, would you take them back to the island where they landed after they left the HMS Bounty? And so he got to thinking about it and said, my insurance wouldn't be valid because in my trip plan, I had to file with the insurance company. I am not allowed to go out of the way like that. But he took the chance, and for the rest of his life, that was the thing he was proudest of, that he had brought them back to the island where they could be happy. But when he came back from a voyage, his wife had died, and it was a very sad situation there. But it also was true that he had these two small children, and he knew that he couldn't go back out to sea again. But he had a brother who lived in Nashville who had a company there, and the brother invited him to come and become a salesman with the company, and he had moved to Nashville, and he brought the flag with him, and that flag was the one that the ladies' auxiliary in this New England town had sewn for him as a gift for the first ship that he commanded, and it was meant so much to him. He said, I think I'll call her Old Glory. And so from that time on, that was the flag that was the original Old Glory. And so when General Grant came into Nashville, he wanted to put that particular flag back up on the Capitol, and so someone told him where William Driver lived, and they came to his house, and he said, yes, I have it, but I've got it sewn in between two sides of the quilt because I was afraid it would be confiscated, and so they unsewed it, and it finally went up. But it would have been so hard to adjust to that kind of thing. One of the most interesting stories out of that period concerned the preacher for the downtown Church of Christ, Brother Philip S. Fall, who was a brother-in-law of Talbert Fanning, preached for that congregation at two different times over a period of many years. And he was so well-respected in the town. But when Andrew Johnson came back to Tennessee as the military governor of the state under Union occupation and was pretty harsh, he said, I've got to teach these people how to be about democracy, and I've got to whip them into line. And he said the best way to do it is to select the most influential people in town and get them to sign a loyalty oath to the United States of America. And so he picked four preachers, a preacher for McKendree Methodist Church and another Methodist church over on the Edgefield side, and the First Baptist Church, and Brother Philip S. Fall, who preached on 7th Avenue or Vine Street at the downtown Church of Christ. And he called them into his office in the Capitol, same Capitol we have still, and he said, I have a loyalty oath, and I want you to sign it right now that you're loyal to the United States of America. And all four of them asked for more time. And so he said, well, you come back tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock and be ready to sign or else. And so when they came back at 4 o'clock the next day, the Baptist preacher, the two Methodist preachers, said, we don't mean to create any trouble for you in any way or anything, but all of our brothers and husbands and sweethearts and fathers and sons are away in the Confederate Army and in the field, and we just cannot bring ourselves to sign this loyalty oath to the United States because of our connections with them. And so he had them put into the prison in kind of an inner prison where they couldn't see, have any windows out, could have no visitors, and he humiliated them by having them walk down Church Street with a bayonet point into the jail. But Brother Philip S. Fall was a whole different case. He had an answer for Governor Andrew Johnson, who was later, of course, President Johnson, Andrew Johnson. He said, well, I am not a natural-born American citizen. He said, I was born in Britain, and I immigrated to this country. And a few years ago in Frankfort, Kentucky, I was sworn in as a citizen of the United States and spoke my allegiance to the United States of America. And he said, that should be good enough. And so Andrew Johnson said, well, that doesn't mean a thing. That was then, and this is now. Go ahead and sign, and don't quit stalling. Well, Brother Fall said, well, if that loyalty oath that I signed at Frankfort, Kentucky a few years ago doesn't mean a thing, then that means that I'm not an American citizen and I'm a subject of Queen Victoria in Britain. And he said, I think Queen Victoria would be very upset with you for being rude with me. And so Governor Johnson, the last thing he wanted was trouble with Britain, the last thing President Lincoln wanted. And so Andrew Johnson, for the rest of the war, the 3 years that remained, was not bothered anymore. In fact, he put a little Union Jack British flag out in front of the church building, and he said, any civic group that wants to meet, you don't have to get government permission, just come and meet. And so he was so highly respected and so well-liked that he was able to accomplish that. But there must have been a lot of times when people are in conflict of adjusting back and forth when there are changes in government. But the point that Jesus made is we have a loyalty to the government and a responsibility, and certainly a higher loyalty to God. But let's read just a little bit more in verse 23. When they heard these words, they marveled and left him and went their way. So the Herodians don't have any more argument. And the Sadducees do, though. The same day came to him the Sadducees, which say that there is no resurrection, and asked him, saying, Moses, Master Moses said, and this was in Deuteronomy 5:25, if a man die having no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up seed into his brother. And notice the case that they bring up, whether it was real or fictional, we're not told. Now there were with us seven brethren, and the first, when he had married a wife, deceased, and having no issue, left his wife unto his brother. Likewise the second also, and the third unto the seventh. And last of all, the woman died also. I never heard of a case like that, but they had one like that. Therefore, in the that's the only place I have heard of one like that. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be of the seven? For they all had her. They thought this conclusively proved there couldn't be any resurrection because it would end up with one woman with seven husbands, and they just couldn't feature that could ever work. But Jesus answered and said unto them, ye do err, not knowing the Scriptures, nor the power of God. So notice they were in error in two ways. They didn't recognize the power of God, that God could deal with any kind of situation, and that he can change our physical relationship to spiritual, and there's not going to be, as he says, any marriage in heaven, or giving in marriage, but we'll be as angels in heaven. So it doesn't mean we won't know each other, won't recognize each other, but God will take care of all those situations where there will be no problems. It's a lack of faith in the power of God to think that God would have insurmountable problems. But notice another way that they were in error was that they didn't know the Scriptures. And Jesus goes on to say in verse 30, for in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven, spiritual beings. But as touching the resurrection of the dead, have ye not read that which was spoken unto you by God, saying, I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And when the multitude heard this, they were astonished at his doctrine. Now, you may remember that these words of God were spoken to Moses at the burning bush, as recorded in Exodus, long years after Abraham and Isaac and Jacob had all died. And Jesus says, God's not the God of the dead, but the living. But God didn't say, I was the God of Abraham, or I used to be, or I have been. But he said, I am, present time, now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, showing that these three men were still in existence. They didn't cease to exist. And you remember, as the discussion is given in the book of Acts, that the Sadducees did not believe in any life after death. They didn't believe in any resurrection. They didn't believe in angels or spirits. And so this was their favorite argument, where they thought they had an insurmountable problem, but they didn't even recognize the Scripture where God said, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. And we remember in Jesus' public ministry, another two patriarchs who reappeared for that short time at the Mount of Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah. I was mentioning about Brother Fall and the place where he preached for many years, but just two doors down from that was the Vine Street Jewish Temple. that was there for many years on that same street, just one house between the two buildings, and the people who lived in that one house were named Page, and some people humorously said that this was the page between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Jewish synagogue and the Church of Christ. One Friday evening, many years ago, when it was still at that location, it was the Reformed Jewish denomination, the most liberal of the three main line denominations of Jews, the Orthodox, the Conservative, and the Reform, the ultra-liberals. The Reformed Jews, there was a rabbi, a so-called rabbi, in a discussion a few years ago, and I have a quotation from the Tennessean newspaper, where they selected three representatives. They selected Reuben Shelley to be one, and then they selected a Catholic priest, I believe, and this liberal Jewish rabbi. And they were discussing different questions from the audience in this kind of interfaith gathering. And someone asked this liberal Jewish rabbi, so-called, what about an atheist? If he's a good moral man, can he go to heaven? And this rabbi said, well, yes, an atheist can go to heaven just as quickly as anybody else. So it shows how little that they really believe in doctrine. But on this particular occasion, I saw people going in. It was on a Friday evening at the beginning of the Sabbath, and I decided I'd just walk in and see what it was all about. And I had two really enlightening experiences, and one was that there was this huge stack of Bibles on a table back in the back of the auditorium, and I picked up one and flipped through, you know, and I came to the end, and the shock I can still remember today, it was the fourth chapter of Malachi. And even though I knew, I'd heard people say and knew that they did not accept the New Testament, actually to flip through one of the Bibles and see that it ended with the fourth chapter of Malachi, it made me realize how true it is that the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed and the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed, and how hopelessly impossible it is to understand the New without the Old having its fulfillment in the New. But I asked one of the men afterward about their belief, and it was very much like the Sadducees. They had had a memorial service that evening, and that was what prompted my question for the ones who had died 1 year ago this week and 5 years ago. And they said, we have only the vaguest thoughts about that, if at all. So they were so similar to the Sadducees in that way. But I want to read this last one before closing, where the Pharisees, verse 34, but when the Pharisees had heard that he had put the Sadducees to silence, they were gathered together. Then one of them, which was a lawyer, asked him a question tempting him and saying, Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Jesus said unto them, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And notice he gives even more information. He says, and the second is like unto it, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So Jesus had no hesitation in answering that question, but it had been such a controversy through the years among the different teachers and different positions that were taken. They had tabulated all the hundreds of commandments in the law of Moses and had counted how many of them were positive commandments and how many of them were negative commandments and were disputing about which was the greatest. But when he gave this as the greatest and then went on and gave the second greatest, it was the perfect answer, because it was so true that even something as basic as the Ten Commandments given by God to Israel long ago, all can be summarized under one or the other of those two heads. And, of course, even in the Christian age, and I'll close with this verse from Paul's writing to the Romans, when he said, Owe no man anything save to love one another, for he that loveth his neighbor hath fulfilled the law. For this, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not commit adultery, and if there be any other commandment, it is all summed up in this word, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill toward his neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of the law. So even though there were many detailed laws in the Christian age, and we need to give attention to them all, they come under the heading of our loyalty and love for God and our responsibility to our fellow man.